Welcome to the West Harland Way Race Podcasts. I'm John Kinston, and this is episode 87. Welcome back to the latest West Harland Way Race Podcast. This podcast is slightly different in that it's an outside broadcast. Last night we had our West Harland Way Race Inspiration Night in Stirling, and we reckon there was probably about 70 or so people. Didn't count them, but I think that's how many were booked in. But it was a great turnout, and we had various speakers and a question and answer panel. So over the next two podcasts, this one and the next one, I'm going to put out the talks. So in this episode, and there'll be two talks that will be shown. The first one is by Tess Kappa, who is a performance sport nutritionist, and she talks about good nutrition in training and for endurance athletes. She's done some studies on beetroot juice particularly, and is doing a PhD in that study. So that will be interesting to see how that works out in the future. And then the second talk is Dr. Chris Ellis, who's been involved with the West Harland Way Race for the last 10 years as our doctor, and Sean Stone, who's involved in the medical side as well as organising the volunteers. So their talk. I also interviewed Ian Beattie in the middle of the session of the evening, and I'll put that on at the beginning for Ian to introduce the evening. And then the next podcast will be the Question Time, where we had Debbie and Marco Consani, Fiona Ross and Tony Thistlethwaite were our panel. But that lasts about an hour, so I thought I'd do that as a separate podcast. So I hope if you were there last night, then you may be listening to this to listen again, and that's great. But if you couldn't make it to the Inspiration Night, then hopefully you'll be able to catch the talks, particularly on the nutrition and the health one on this one, both really key topics to do well in the West Harland Way Race, or in fact any ultra. So I hope you enjoy this episode, recorded live from Stirling. Okay, we're in the break of our Inspiration Night, and I'm with race director Ian Beattie. So Ian, just tell us why we did this, or why we do these Inspiration Evenings, and what you think people should get from it.
We've been doing these Inspiration Evenings for quite a number of years now, and it's followed up a similar format but with different speakers each year. I think it's a great opportunity just to bring people, particularly those who haven't done the race before, and just let them benefit from all the experience that other people have. We've already heard tonight, we've heard from nutritionists, we've heard from our medical people. Hugely important to get these messages out there, and I think sometimes I look around the room and I can see the terrified faces when Chris Ellis is giving his medical stories, but it's all done to make sure people are as well prepared as they possibly can.
Okay, so for those who couldn't make it tonight, hopefully they'll listen to this podcast if they're listening to it now. But is there anything else that you particularly want to just put across at this stage? The race is, 4 months away? Any major things that you think people should be thinking about and working towards?
I would suggest that, there's all the things that you're going to hear about your training clearly and your planning, and that's all fine. I would encourage you to start thinking about the logistics of the race as well. Where are you going to stay in Fort William? It's not got the huge amount of accommodation. Where are you going to go get that booked? Are you going to stay till through the Sunday night post-race party? Try and, if you can, don't leave straight afterwards. The prize giving's a fantastic thing to be at. Do you need accommodation, Mogai, on the Friday night? There's quite a lot to think about there. So the whole planning of that and how you're going to do it. Support vehicles, it's one of the things we're really not keen at all on, people having big motorhome type vehicles. We ask, if you are bringing a camper van, restrict it to transit size only and no bigger than that. So again, start thinking about all of these things and just planning to make the weekend as easy as you possibly can by the time you get there.
Yeah. And just personally, Ian, I know that you've got a big challenge this year. Do you want to tell us what you're working towards and how that's going?
Yes, well, I'm doing this year the double Catarin 110 miles. It's quite a scary challenge in some ways. I've not done a race of this length since 2010, when I did a 24-hour race. So I'm 6 years out. That means I'm 6 years older. It means I'm 6 years away from doing this training. But I think so far the training's going pretty well. I've had a 211-mile January, including, and I'm throwing everything into that. I'm doing track sessions once a week. I'm doing long runs, I'm getting time in my feet. So, yeah, if I can still be feeling it's going well come end of March into April, I'll start to feel a bit more confident, I think.
Okay. Well, maybe after the race, we'll get you on a podcast and you can tell us all about it. So thanks for organising tonight. And I say, hopefully people will listen to these who couldn't make it along, and maybe some who are here will listen to it again. So thank you very much.
Thanks for coming. There's a lot to get through, so we'll get on with our first speaker right away, who is from a running family, Tess Kappa. Her dad, Graham, is a coach with Gala Harriers down in the Borders and looks after a lot of athletes there. Tess is a performance sports nutritionist. Sorry. She's done a lot of work with beetroot juice lately, which she'll probably bring into her talk in subtle tones. I know that's a hot topic with ultra runners. She's also a nutritionist with Edinburgh Academicals, and without further ado, we're going to hand over to Tess for her talk on nutrition for training. Hey, Tess.
Hello. Okay, let's. So as Adrian said, my name is Tess. I am registered with the Association for Nutrition, Sport and Exercise Nutrition Register, as a graduate, and I'm just starting a PhD at Newcastle Uni, which, as Adrian said, I'm looking at beetroot and health and exercise, so it might be something that interests you. I'll just get going, because I've probably got too many things to talk about. But let's just have a quick overview about why we train and how your diet can influence it. So, we train to improve exercise performance, to induce changes in the structure and function of skeletal muscle and other tissues. And this response is proportional to the training loads, the intensity, duration, frequency of training. The responses to training are induced by alterations in the rate of synthesis and degradation of proteins. So basically what we want to do is increase the proportion of functional proteins in the muscle and reduce the proportion of non-functional proteins. This is all modulated by nutrient, metabolic and hormonal environment. And these all in turn are modified by your food intake before, during and after training. So thinking about diet can be as important as thinking about your training. So your eating plan as well as your training plan for the next however long. So what's the best diet? It's always going to be the one that works best for you. Nutrition is very individualistic. What works for someone else isn't going to work for you necessarily. It's a lot about trial and error, finding what foods suit you, what foods don't, what you can have before a run, what you can't. I can't stand here and give you the best breakfast. It's going to be very personal. It's all about experimenting and getting. I'm going to try and cover the essentials, but not be too basic. We'll have some experienced runners, maybe some newbies. So trying to cover all the important bits, but not being too basic about it all. But what I tend to tell my clients when if they come to me and say about firing straight on nutrient timing or supplements, think about this pyramid and start from the bottom. So for endurance athletes, getting enough energy is going to be your first priority. Supplements are going to come right at the end once everything below that in the pyramid is right. So as we kind of plan your diet, think about these. We'll cover just the basics in a second, but just bear this pyramid in mind and thinking energy intake always has to come first. Then we go on to your macronutrients, your carbohydrate, protein, and fat. Then comes into your micronutrition, whether you're getting enough iron, calcium, etc. After that comes meal timing and frequency. And then right at the end, once you've got everything else right, that's when you can maybe introduce some supplements. So the basics kind of sports nutrition, which I like to tell people is first off, as I said, meet your energy requirements, and these are based on your training load. As your training load goes up, your energy requirements are going to go up. Second, achieving a suitable body composition. If you need to lose weight to run faster, then using nutrition to kind of help you do that. Supporting recovery, which we'll come on to later, fueling training runs. Reducing illness and injury is going to be a big one, and that's where recovery can come in as well. Thinking about the foods that can kind of help aid recovery and help you get onto your next run. As I said, making informed decisions on nutritional supplements. Is your diet the best that it can be? Are you getting everything you need or everything you can from food before you think about supplements? This is a big one that I kind of want you to think about as well, eating in a way that supports long-term health, not just thinking about the performance of one specific run. And also hydration, which we'll come on to a little bit later as well. So, as I said, when you're thinking of planning out your diet to complement your training program, thinking about the pyramid that I talked about, meeting your energy requirements right at the start, calories in, calories out. Achieving a suitable body composition, as I said, you can regulate your calorie intake, still going from the bottom of the pyramid. Supporting recovery, it's all about planning what's in the cupboard, what's in the fridge, what you've got at work if you need it, not coming in after a long run and thinking, oh my god, I need something to eat right now and you haven't got anything in the cupboards. Reducing illness and injury, as I said, kind of can come from recovery foods, but also making sure that you've got enough carbohydrate in your diet. Making informed decisions. Nutritional supplements, as I said, thinking about long-term health as opposed to short-term performance, and maybe thinking about how much you sweat and how much you need to rehydrate during and after runs. Thinking about what you can incorporate into your diet as opposed to what things you might need to cut out, and again, enjoying food and thinking about health long term. So nutrition during a race is very personal. Some people will be well practiced, so you know exactly what you choose. Some people might be new. So just a few things that you can think about. Always practice and plan ahead. That's the one big thing that I'm sure everyone will know, but don't experiment on race day. And also, don't wait until you're fatigued to start taking in energy. You want to start consuming things about 30 minutes in. Don't wait until it's too late. Fat and protein are always going to be harder to digest than carbohydrate. So the best foods during a race are high carbohydrate, low fiber, low fat, because they're hard for your body to tolerate, and anything that's easy on the stomach. So once again, things that you've practiced. Thinking about your drop bags, what you're going to have in them. Have options. You might change your mind halfway and think, I really need something salty if the sun comes out, or I really want something sweet. Have options in the drop bags just in case you kind of, you change your mind, but always make sure you've practiced with both of your options. So let's just think about recovery. As I said, it's going to be forward planning, making sure you've prepared what's in your cupboards, what's in your fridge. And your recovery nutrition is going to influence what you can do the next day or the day after that. It's going to determine the quality of your next run. The first and foremost is to replenish your glycogen, get your energy stores back up to allow you to then train the next day. You also want to provide amino acids to help kickstart muscle repair and recovery. And the basic kind of optimum recovery kind of ratio is about 3 or 4 parts carbohydrate to protein. So thinking about that in your recovery nutrition, thinking a little bit more carbohydrate than protein, but making sure that you get both in there. And your recovery nutrition definitely depends on what you're doing next. I was at the International Sports Nutrition Conference in December, and the nutritionist from Team Sky, so who works with the Tour de France cyclists, they very much look at carbohydrate periodization. So not just coming in after a long cycle and just having loads and loads of carbohydrates and then going, let's say, coming in and having loads and loads of carbohydrates. They need to maintain the weight, they need to stay light. But also if you train, you've heard of kind of training fasted and it inducing kind of adaptations in your muscle. And that can often work a little bit better if you don't have loads and loads of glycogen in your muscles. So thinking about if you come in after a long race and then think next day is actually just quite an easy, or it's maybe a rest day, or it's just a few miles as opposed to 50 mile, do you need loads and loads of carbohydrate in afterwards? You might get a better adaptation if you have maybe low to moderate carbohydrate afterwards, if you can have an easy day the next day. So just think about this 3-to-1 ratio, but recovery definitely depends on what you're doing the next day. So as I said, it's all about glycogen replenishment. You can do that in 24 hours. So try and eat something immediately, but remember that over the next 24 hours, anything you eat is still going to be replacing your glycogen. So don't get too put off if you can't eat within this 30-minute window or an hour window. It will be slightly more optimal to have that, but anything you eat, try and space out eating every 2-3 hours, and you will replace your glycogen enough to be able to go again the next day. As I said about reducing illness and injury, delaying your carbohydrate, as I said, might not impair your glycogen because you are going to be consuming it throughout the day anyway, but it can impact on your immune function and your bone health. And also exercising with low carbohydrate reserves can increase the kind of levels of stress hormones, which can impact on your immune system as well. So as I said, kind of thinking about long-term health as opposed to immediate performance. So intense prolonged exercise when you're training hard, you will get a dip in your immune response immediately afterwards, and we'll come on to recovery foods. But that's the time where you're more at risk of things like coughs and colds and kind of upper respiratory tract infections. So thinking about how your diet is going to affect your overall immune function. So this 3-to-1 ratio, combining carbohydrate and protein, the kind of optimal maybe meal is to have something like pasta, potatoes and rice, some source of protein, and lots of vegetables. These are some kind of examples of things you can have. I'm throwing chocolate milk in there because it's the best recovery drink. It's got lots of electrolytes. It's a really good combination of carbohydrate and protein. Thinking about getting your omega-3s, your antioxidants, and also for runners, getting your calcium in is really important for your bone health. When you're training hard, endurance athletes, thinking about what you can add to your diet, as I said before, and thinking about introducing anti-inflammatory foods. So things like spices like turmeric and garlic and ginger are all anti-inflammatory. Getting lots of omega-3s, thinking about getting your calcium, your vitamin D, loads of antioxidants, selenium in Brazil nuts, that's a really potent antioxidant, and thinking about reducing your intake of processed foods and refined carbohydrates, because they're kind of pro-inflammatory, And the last thing you want is to kind of, on top of all the training that you're doing, introducing foods that are going to have a negative response. So thinking about anti-inflammatory foods as a kind of good recovery. So let's just talk about hydration. Fatigue towards the end of a prolonged event. Yes, you will be low glycogen, but also you can feel more fatigued if you're dehydrated. When you're dehydrated, your heart has to work harder to pump blood around the body. So the last thing you want when your heart is pumping really hard is for it to have to work even harder because you've not taken in enough water. And also beginning an exercise in a dehydrated state can be harmful. And it's going to impair your next training, so just thinking about that as recovery. Additional salt can be useful to add, maybe in drop bags or afterwards. Your other electrolytes, you do find them quite a lot in fruit and fruit juices, so if you habitually have a lot of fruit and fruit juices afterwards anyway, then chances are you're getting enough of the electrolytes that you would get in something like Lucozade or powder. But thinking about maybe adding a little bit of salt to help you rehydrate. You retain water better if you have a little sodium in it. If you take in only water, your kidneys just try and get rid of the excess fluid. So you'll, and sodium also increases your thirst. So you'll drink more because water kind of switches off your thirst before you might be fully rehydrated. So just thinking about, one, in terms of recovery, and thinking about during your race whether adding a little bit of sodium into your drinks might be a good idea. You can work out your sweat rates quite easily. It's maybe a good thing to think about. It's just a basic. So weighing yourself before and after training and seeing how much weight you've lost in sweat. So if you lost a kilogram of weight in sweat, then you need to replace that by 1.5 times that in water. So just think about that as you're planning your diet. A little bit about protein. Never to be forgotten with endurance people, it's not all about carbohydrates. Proteins have loads of functions in the body, helping your muscles repair, also transporting things around the body, good for the immune function. Doesn't always have to be meat. Fish and dairy, you can get protein from lots of legumes, whole grains, plant-based protein powders. You see a lot of people promoting peanut butter as a protein source. It's not a protein source, it's a fat source. So don't just consume lots of nuts and seeds and think that you're getting loads of protein. It's mostly fat and it's high calorie. So not the ideal protein source, but still a good thing to have in your diet. You also maybe have heard people say that plant-based proteins aren't complete proteins, which they aren't. They're harder for your body to use because they don't contain all the essential amino acids. But you don't have to eat them all at the same time. Your body is good at reserving amino acids to use later on. So as long as you're consuming lots of different types of protein, legumes, whole grains, things like that, over the space of the day, then you should be able to achieve your protein intakes. Thinking about, it's maybe a little bit specific, but about 0.4 grams per kilogram of protein for recovery to help your muscles get all the amino acids that they need. And also thinking about another thing from the Sports Nutrition Conference was that they're now looking at protein on a meal-for-meal basis as opposed to a daily intake. It's just better and easier for your body to use. So spacing it out and not having all of your protein in an evening meal where you have kind of 60 grams of protein, it's kind of too much for your body to process at once. So spacing it out, it will depend on your weight, your height and weight and things like that, but spacing it out maybe 20 to 30 grams of protein per meal is just a lot easier for your body to take. My favourite subject is beetroot. So as I said, I'm doing a PhD on beetroot for health and exercise. You've probably heard a lot about it. I used to work in Holland & Barrett and used to sell it in the shops. And all I really need to tell people that it gives you a runner's high. I didn't know what that meant at the time. But it's the nitrate in the beetroot gets broken down into nitric oxide in the body. Nitric oxide is a vasodilator, so it means that it widens your blood vessels, lets more oxygen around the body, which goes on to improve performance. People have been taking it for years to reduce blood pressure, and it still does that. And that's always going to be good for any athlete to reduce blood pressure. Most of these are in kind of intermittent short burst exercise when you're looking at really strong improved performance. But more recently, another PhD student I know has been looking at beetroot as a recovery. So it's not just the nitrate in beetroot that's good, it's all the antioxidants. There's things called betalains in them, which are really good for the body. So people have been finding that they're kind of, there's a reduction in pain, inflammation and oxidative stress after exercise when beetroot's consumed. So not just thinking about the whole blood pressure and nitric oxide thing, but thinking about beetroot for other reasons. So you should be able to get enough nitrate and nitric oxide to reduce blood pressure and help with performance from about 150 to 250 grams of beetroot. Or other nitrate-rich vegetables like rocket, lettuce, things like that. So if you kind of top up your nitrate daily, then you might see an improved performance. But if you do want to just use the shots and use the concentrate, then thinking about having about two a day in the lead up to a race, and then one on race day as close to the race as possible, and you might see some good effects there. There will be non-responders and responders to beetroot. It depends on your training status, and it also depends on how much nitrate you've already got going around your body. But it's always something that you can experiment with. You can now buy kind of concentrate bottles, so you can play around with your own dose, as opposed to just using the doses that are kind of in the shot. I'm going to stop rambling on. Just leave you with this quote from a really good sports nutritionist, and just think about how your diet can complement your training program. Thank you very much.
Great pleasure in introducing our next two speakers this year. I think familiar faces to many of us. First of all, Dr. Chris Ellis. Chris has been involved with the race since 2006, so has a wealth of experience. It's probably worth saying that Chris was a GP at Kinlochleven in 2005 race with quite a few medical issues, and Chris heard about this, got involved, was very keen to get involved in the race, and has subsequently become one of the leading experts in the world in terms of medical support for ultra endurance races like this. Also, the presentation, another familiar face, Sean Stone. Sean's been involved in race safety for the race since, I think, the early 2000s, maybe even earlier than that. And again, he'll be a familiar face. Sean's got overall responsibility for the safety on race day. So if I can hand over to both Chris and Sean.
Okay, so my name is Chris Ellis, but you've already heard that, and I think this is the 10th time I've given this talk, and it's the 10th time I'll be saying, I hope this is the last time you meet me. So yeah, I've been involved with the West Island Way Race since 2005. That year my involvement was only as a GP in the Lough Arbour area with an interest in sports medicine, who heard about the rather large number of arrivals in the Belford Hospital, and stuck my nose into what was going on, and we had four people with disturbance that was just written up in the sports medical literature, the metabolic disorder of low sodium, which I'll be talking about in due course. Fortunately, from memory, that's the last time we saw that phenomenon, and I'd like to think that at least some of the explanation for that lies with the fact that people are now slightly better informed. So the concept of mishap after running a long way is hardly new, and if you believe the fairy tales, sudden death has been reported as far back as 2,500 years ago. Unfortunately, sudden death still continues to happen, and hopefully when you leave tonight, you'll have some better ideas trying to avoid that one. So with regard to exertional disorders, I've subdivided them into the categories as per the slide. So broadly speaking, they're localized phenomena which may affect just one part of the body, or they may be systemic phenomena which affect the whole of the body. So with regard to the localized phenomena, I'll be mentioning a few of those at the end. And with regard to the systemic phenomena, I'll mention briefly sudden death. By the time that happens, I'm afraid I can't help you. But do need to recognize that in the course of prolonged exertion, the possibility of sudden death does exist, and if death is sudden, then it's usually a cardiac cause, and the particular cardiac cause is governed, rule of thumb, by age, whereby if you're under 35, your cardiac death will be due to some defect with which you were born, and if you die a cardiac cause over 35, it will be because your arteries are narrowed. So, with regard to the other disorders, the systemic disorders, they're subdivided into two groups. The first group is disorders of extreme physiology. I'm going to take a whistle-stop tour through those. Now, by far and away, the commonest physiological phenomenon that we encounter in long-distance races is this fellow with its very long name, but don't get too bogged down in that, exercise-associated postural hypertension. In effect, that's fainting. This is a phenomenon of which a huge meal is made completely needlessly, because it's often interpreted as something it isn't and not recognised for what it is. And the features are pretty clear-cut, that they arise very shortly after discontinuing activity, and by shortly I mean a large number of seconds to a short number of minutes. And the individual who keels over had no prior symptoms and full recovery within 10 to 15, maybe 20 minutes is normal. And it requires no treatment other than to be left lying where you are. So the picture is fairly typical. The individual crosses the line, celebrates finishing, greets his friend, and then keels over. We must see a 10 a year?
Typically, yes.
10 each year.
10 is quite normal as a population of 200.
Yeah, the commonest time that it happens is just at the end, but I've seen it in Kinoth even at the end of the stage. So, if you've got those ingredients, those features, then that's what it is. Leave them lying where they are, put their feet up, and within 10 or 15 minutes they're usually good to go. So, with regard to collapse, there are some rules of thumb whereby collapse shortly after finishing a stage or the race is usually this phenomenon, exercise-associated postural hypertension. Collapse while running is, as a rule of thumb, serious and warrants a medical opinion. Okay, the next physiological phenomenon is that the core temperature can rise just through exertion. And here's some data from the Singapore Half Marathon with a dozen or so people who had temperature-sensitive monitors, which they swallowed, and their temperatures were recorded throughout the race. So you can see that every single one of them incurred some degree of temperature rise. It's a phenomenon of which they were unaware, and it is of no significance. What is interesting is that quite a few of them, the temperatures rose above what ordinarily you might regard as the cutoff for heat stroke. But in the absence of the other phenomena of heat stroke, it's clearly not. And I suppose we never know who has these temperatures because we're not generally monitoring people's temperature. But just out of interest, you can see that a rising core temperature is a normal physiological phenomenon. So the next physiological norm is muscle breakdown or rhabdomyolysis. And here are measurements of the muscle breakdown enzyme creatinine kinase, and the normal level is below 200. Here are the levels of 67 people who finished the West Highland Way race in 2009 and reported themselves to be well. And you can see that muscle breakdown is universal. So if that's the only thing that happens, that the muscles hurt and the enzyme is raised, then that's a physiological phenomenon, and to my way of thinking, innocent. And then finally, the next physiological phenomenon is weight loss. And I distinguish weight loss, which normally arises to the tune of between 2 and 4% of start weight, and I distinguish percent weight loss from percent dehydration, because they aren't one and the same. The party line with regards to the explanation for weight loss is a so-called gelatin phenomenon, whereby glycogen-loaded muscles prior to the event, in conjunction to taking glycogen into the muscle, each gram of glycogen takes 1 or 2 mils of water, such that when the glycogen is metabolically consumed, that water is liberated and is available for use as per any other form of water. And therein lies the explanation for the weight loss, or part of the explanation for weight loss. So if you're carbo-loaded to the tune of 400 to 600 grams of glycogen, you can appreciate that you may have an extra 1,500 mils of water in conjunction with that, and the whole lot adds up to 2 kgs. So if you're completely glycogen depleted at the end of the race, you can easily drop a couple of kilos, and that's entirely metabolic and is not dehydration or weight loss. That's not to say that dehydration or weight loss can't also occur, but the only fraction of the weight loss incurred, certainly if your weight loss is between 2 and 4%, only a small percentage of that weight loss need be dehydrational. And our findings from the West Highland Way Race in 2009 tally with similar studies and other events. Interestingly, and I have to be careful on how I sell this slide, that there's an association between the percent of weight that an individual loses and favourable performance. If you look at data from the West Highland Way Race 2009 and say South Africa Ironman data from 2001 and 2, you'll see that those people who lose the most weight tend to run the fastest times. Now, let me emphasise how cautiously I'm selling this. I'm not advocating deliberately drying yourself up in order to run a fast time, but what I am saying is that those people who seem naturally capable of coping with a degree of fluid depletion seem also capable of running a fast time. So that's a matter of your makeup, not a matter of deliberately dehydrating yourself. I hope that message is clear. Okay, so having gone through the extreme physiological entities, I'm now going to move on to the disease processes of which this exercise-associated hyponatremia, EAH, or low sodium, is one. It's kind of burst onto the scene in the last 15, 20 years, first described in South Africa in 1985 by Noakes, and it's very important that people appreciate the underlying process whereby sodium level falls. It is not, I emphasise, not a depletion of sodium. It's a dilution of the body sodium by taking on too much fluid. Okay, and that's a very important thing to appreciate. So the body has defence mechanisms whereby it can hang on to its own fluid, and in some people those defence mechanisms are particularly fierce. So that normally after a period of exertion of about 4 hours, they come into play whereby you hang on to fluid and don't pee much. So if you happen to be at the more developed end of that spectrum and drink excessively, you can become fluid overloaded, and by virtue of the dilutional effect of sodium from fluid overload, some serious consequences arise, particularly waterlogging of the brain. And the spectrum of problems that go with that, starting with confusion, progressing to fits, then coma, and then, if you're unlucky, death. So this is a real phenomenon. It's been described in many big city marathons. Once the duration of exercise gets beyond about 4 hours, you're prone to this. And as I said, four cases presented themselves to the Belford Hospital in 2005, although fortunately they were on the kind of having convulsions and impaired conscious level spectrum, and all came good. So This is one to try and avoid, and you can take considerable measures to ensure it doesn't happen. One is to use thirst as your drinking guide rather than the clock. And the other is to avoid disposition by taking anti-inflammatory medications. So those are probably the two things that you can do to reduce your chances. So just by way of some data, here are some comparative sodium levels for finishers from the West Highland Way Race in 2009 and the Western States Endurance Run, isn't it, 2009, by a colleague who did similar measurements there. And it really does show the difference between folk this side of the Atlantic from our American counterparts. So normal sodium normal sodium is, what, depending on your laboratory, around 135 to 144, something like that. Slight variation between one lab and the next. And you can see that the sodium levels of the West Highland Way Race finishers tend to be towards the upper end of normal, whereas the sodium levels in the American finishers tend to be either low normal or low. That reflects the different emphasis on hydration strategies, I suspect, between the United States and not just the UK, but between the United States and most of the rest of the world. That's a rather contentious area in the medical literature, and you better just read that for yourselves rather than hearing more from me. But you have to admit that data is fairly impressive evidence of the difference in hydration strategies. You might argue that those in the West Highland Way Race with the borderline high sodium may be running slightly dry, but that is far less problematic, if indeed a problem at all, than running with low sodiums. Okay, now then, I mentioned that muscle breakdown in the physiological section was an innocent phenomenon, and indeed it is, but occasionally it can progress, and the breakdown products of the muscle lodge in the kidneys, impair its function to the degree that the kidney fat packs up. And there's some manifestations of that, including a kind of Coca-Cola-like urine. And having heard Tess just now advocate beetroot extract, that worries me slightly in terms of interpretation of this phenomenon and distinguishing the effects of too much beetroot from pathological rhabdomyolysis. To a degree, this is a less preventable phenomenon than exercise-associated hyponatremia, but there's no doubt that anti-inflammatory takers are inordinately overrepresented amongst those who develop kidney failure from rhabdomyolysis. So, in my opinion, here's yet another reason to avoid anti-inflammatory medications in long-distance running. And the cases who I've encountered from the West Highland Way Race, of which there have been two, who have run into acute renal failure, were both taking anti-inflammatories, and that tallies with findings of my counterparts in Dolphin and other races. So here's another pathological disorder, heat stroke, and I'm glad to say I've never seen it and hope I never do. So not only does this involve an elevation of core temperature, but it also involves some breakdown of bodily processes and some impairment of brain functioning. And you need to be onto it fairly quickly that this is what's going on and try and implement cooling measures before it gets out of hand, because this is potentially another killer. So that is the end of my trip through the systemic disorders, both extreme physiology and pathological. And I'll close now with mention of a couple of localized phenomena which affect predominantly the lower limbs. So the first of these is compartment syndrome, whereby a group of muscles within its fascial envelope can become profoundly swollen and compress its own blood supply, with the ultimate result that the muscles within the fascial envelope all break down. And if that happens, then it's quite a serious phenomenon, and the dead muscle ultimately will need to be removed. So ideally, you cop on to compartment syndrome before that happens. And the classic feature is a pain within a group of muscles greater than can be accounted for by any other explanation. By the time you've got pins and needles downstream of the site of pain, you're probably pushing your luck with regard to viability of the muscle group. So if you've got severe pain in a muscle group, and the muscle group most commonly affected is in the calf, greater than it can be explained by any other phenomenon, then consider this and act early. And then the other common localized phenomenon from long distance running is stress fracture. And a large number of, any bone can be stress fractured, but by far and away the two commonest in running are the second metatarsal there and the tibia. So that's me. I hope the message about drinking too much has been conveyed. I don't think I can portray it any less subtly than that. So, to conclude, there are some guidelines on the do's and don'ts with which I urge you to be familiar. Drink by thirst, stay away from anti-inflammatories. You can keep an eye on your weight, and there's facilities to help you with that. Heat exhaustion as a diagnosis doesn't exist, and diagnose dehydration cautiously because that rarely applies. If you do need to seek medical help, and a few do, subsequent to kind of leaving the scene of the race, take the guidelines with you and the urine sample, and maybe urge whoever's looking after you to do some blood tests, because it's quite likely whoever's looking after you hasn't encountered these phenomena. And with regard to administration of IV fluids, then don't go pouring fluids into poorly people who may already be fluid overloaded without first knowing the sodium. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you, Chris. One more thing to add on the end of that really is... you know what, I've just lost my thread. I had a clear... Yeah, that'd be fine. Thank you. What I was going to say there was that we do publish a set of guidelines on the medical complications of ultra running. Chris is the author of these. Please, if you're coming to the event for the first time, make sure that you've got a printed copy of those with you, with your support team, and as Chris referred to there, you take that with you. If you find yourself heading to an AD unit, for example, and you've got a paper copy with you, that helps explain to people who might have less experience of the complications of ultra running than Chris, here's a few things for that team to look at when they're looking at the casualty. What I wanted to do was a really quick sort of gallop through the things that happen on the race from kind of from my perspective, a quick run through what happens on the race weekend from the point of view of the medic who's going to have to clean up some of the mess afterwards. And that is really the things that are going to prevent somebody from finishing their race. Our objective is to see you get to the finish. As many as possible runners we want to see successfully getting to the finish without breaking themselves in the process. And that means we do need a little bit of preparation from your side as well, in addition to just the running. There's a bit of thought has to go into it as well. But the main things that can stop somebody finishing their race are really three things. You physically break yourself, so you do damage to your body that prevents it from continuing. You physiologically become unable to function, which is what Chris has just been referring to just now. And the final one is you run out of fuel, which is Tess was covering a short while ago. Those are those three areas that you do have to focus on. What I would like to add is before, I'll structure this in the way that the race tends to come together. So in advance of the race start, when you're registering, it's quite an exciting place for people who've never been there before. There's a big crowd of people. There's a lot going on. Lots of friends are meeting each other again. It's good fun. There's a big atmosphere there at the start. Some people find that quite stressful. And maybe it's worth finding a little bit of space to be calm at the start, to prevent yourself becoming too much adrenaline in your system and losing focus on what you're there for, which is to successfully complete the race. You need to be calm at the start. Another thing is... Yes, enjoy that experience, but also take your rings off. I hate seeing sausage fingers at the finish, especially if somebody's fallen and fractured their fingers, and we're going to have to find a way to get those tight rings off a swollen hand. So stop, think, enjoy, and take your rings off, please. Early on in the race, everyone's going to be excited. You're full of adrenaline, and try not to let your enthusiasm exceed your technical ability at this stage of the race. Running while splattered in blood or with bones sticking out at funny angles may look hardcore, but it does tend to worry both the marshals and your own support crew. If you fracture a rib out on the course, your collarbone or your jaw at mile 5, you're probably not going to see on mile 95. As some people here will know, if it's your ankle that you break, you might be fine. You've seen much more information tonight and elsewhere on nutrition, and it's not something I'm going to go into, because as Tess said to you earlier on, it's different for everybody. What works for one person doesn't work for another. I do really back up what Tess said, which is you've got to eat early. You need to eat some real food, small amounts of real food, really early on. That can make a difference to the way that your gut actually handles the coming hours of stress that it's going to be going through. But the tactics vary, and you know, no one thing works for everybody, as Tess was referring to earlier on. Learning how you cope with a long, hard run is part of the journey. One thing that is really important for us is that if you're being sick at the trailside, it's no big deal. Lots of people are sick when they're doing an event of this nature. For some, it's a phase they have to go through at a certain distance, and of course they know that, you know, 40 miles or whatever, they're going to be sick several times, and then they'll start to feel better again and start to absorb food further on. Some people never get past that stage and will always continue being sick occasionally for the rest of the event and can cope with that. For some people, they can't cope with that. But what is really important for us is that you don't hide that fact from your support team. They need to know, we might need to know later on, that you have been sick repeatedly. It could be important further down the line. So don't be afraid of it. It's normal, it's natural. If it happens, fine, cope with it, get on with it afterwards. If you become genuinely ill later, we need to know your history, is what I'm driving at. One issue that does make a big difference to a lot of people is pain management. Chris has referred to non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like ibuprofen. We have a really strong view on that. It's dangerous. Please don't use the stuff. When it comes to pain management, talk to the experts, talk to the runners who are going to be here in the panel later on this evening. Ask them questions about pain management. They'll have tactics. You need to learn some tactics for yourself, things that will work for you. Later on in the race, everybody's getting tired. And I don't mean sore legs and whatever. I mean lacking in concentration, making silly mistakes, driving your car off the side of the road for the support team when they get tired. That has happened on a number of occasions. Your carefully assembled race plan can disintegrate, tempers fray, a mood swing. If you expect it, you'll cope better with it. You might meet Chris Ellis at Kinloch Leven, where he runs his clearing station. That's as in clearing you to carry on. That's the general idea. Up at the finish, where you'll meet me, you're still going to be tired, but there's a wide range of reactions to that, which are normal. Sickness and fainting, minor collapses that Chris was referring to earlier on are common. So don't be surprised if you feel very wrong at the finish for some time or end up lying on the floor with no clear memory of how you got there. It can take a few hours to get back to any kind of normality from this experience. I have seen people who've collapsed at the finish line, as Chris referred to, with the postural hypertension. They go down and it's really difficult to get them back up. It can take a couple of hours. And the moment you try, you think somebody's feeling better, you start to sit them up and they're immediately sick. And they immediately faint on you again after being sick. They're back down again. They're staying there for a bit longer. That could take a couple of hours, but they will come round. It looks a bit scary to the support crew. 99 times out of 100, they're fine. They will be fine. So that's our part of our job, is to patch up the wounds, ice the sore bits, test what needs testing. That's what we're doing, trying to keep you healthy at the finish. We've seen a lot of sick and broken runners over the years. So please do what we ask and then move away from the finish line when we think you're ready. Some runners will recommend after the race should be accompanied by the crew, by friends and family for a few hours, usually reporting back to us later on at a specified time. It's important that this care does happen, as later collapses, while they're rare, do occasionally happen, and they can be quite awkward for the person involved if they, you know, park a car on top of a petrol pump for or collapse in the bathroom and break their ribs against the toilet bowl or something like that. So people need to be accompanied after this event when they finish. They need to be someone keeping an eye on them for a good few hours afterwards, unless they've got a really good history of always being fine, which is fine for some of these guys at the front. Driving. Please don't think about driving yourself home after a big ultra. It's a really bad idea. Make other arrangements. And finally, carry out a tick inspection reasonably soon after finishing and remove them correctly. If you're in any doubt, ask me to do it. Lyme disease does exist in the Highlands. It is a bit of a problem. It's very unpleasant, but it's avoidable if you do something about it. Really, that's all I've got to say. So Chris and I are happy to take any questions from the folk.
There were a few questions after Chris's and Sean's talk, and the first one was about anti-inflammatories and what Chris thought about there. Those asked him to explain a little bit more.
So it's fairly likely that someone be running a West Highland race who's taking one, and as you rightly point out, statins are disposed to rhabdomyolysis, as does long distance running. So you would wonder if there's potentially an exacerbatory effect of statins, and the honest answer is I don't know. Like you, I have wondered, but I can't say that I've seen it or heard of it or even read about it, although you told me about a case just before the show got underway tonight. And my answer to that is I suppose it was only a matter of time before such a phenomenon came to light. So yes, I think if I were on a statin, I'd be more on the lookout for rhabdomyolysis than if I weren't.
Which reminds me that, of course, one of the things we do ask all runners to do is to give us a medical declaration as part of the application process. So please be honest and complete with the material that you give us to work with. There will be a copy of that at the finish line for us to use as a reference document, and it is destroyed afterwards.
On the back of that, would you recommend stopping taking them for a week or so beforehand?
Gee, I'm slightly out of my depth now. That's rather blanket and something that I'm not entirely prepared for. Well, if I translate a similar question that I encounter in my day job, whereby patients on statins, and I, like every GP, have a large number, who come along with various aches and pains, and you're therefore left wondering whether the statin might be responsible, then, very scientifically, what do you think I say? Have a spell off and see. In most folk, or just about everybody, I can't think that's of significance. If you're on your statin because of some ischemic cardiac event, then you're unlikely to be a West Highland Way race participant. So I suspect only people on statins running West Highland Way race are on it for the so-called primary preventative strategy, because they and or their families have got high cholesterol levels. And therefore, I can't think that coming off a statin around the race period would be detrimental. Is that reasonable?
Hope you've enjoyed the latest West Highland Way Race podcast. I say this was part one of two from the outside broadcast of the Inspiration Night last night in Stirling. So we've listened to the first two speakers or the first two talks, and then after the break we had a panel, and there was four people: Fiona Ross, Marco and Debs Consani, and Tony Thistlethwaite, and they answered various questions and that lasted around about an hour. So I'm going to put that onto a separate podcast. So I hope you've enjoyed this one, and there's been some good things that you've learned and picked up. If you were there and you've listened to it again, then hopefully that was good. And if you weren't able to go and you've listened to it now, then at least you got the content of the talks. I forgot to mention at the beginning that I asked Tess, could she send me her PowerPoint slides, which she's done. So I'll put a link to that. So hopefully you found that when you got the link to the podcast. But if you didn't, I'll put it on the West Highland Way Race website, and a link on Facebook as well, so you can see the slides of the talk. Just going to finish with a quote from Wombat Fitness, and this one comes from Bruce Lee, and he says, If you always put a limit on everything you do, it will spread into your work and into your life. There are no limits. There are only plateaus. And you must not stay there. You must go beyond them.